I needed her out of my way.
Our counsel will say, even if you had mistaken but sincere prior suspicions, you should have gone straight for Sameka in the tub and let Harper deal with Lamar behind you. It was two against one. It would have saved you time, right? If you were so concerned with your old buddy.
It might have saved me half a second. Half a second could have been critical, Deerfield said. Life or death medical situation like that? Our counsel will make a big point out of it. He'll say spending precious time hitting somebody proves something, like personal animosity. The room went quiet. Reacher looked down at the table.
Law buff like you knows all about it, Blake said. Honest mistakes occur, but even so, actions in defense of a victim need to happen right at the exact time the victim is getting assaulted, not afterward. Afterward is revenge, pure and simple.
Reacher said nothing.
And you can't claim it was mistaken and accidental, Blake said. You once told me you know all about how to break someone's skull, and no way it would happen by accident. That guy in the alley, remember? Petrosian's boy? And what goes for skulls goes for necks, right? So it wasn't an accident. It was deliberate homicide.
There was silence. Okay, Reacher said. What's the deal?
You're going to jail,
Deerfield said. There's no deal. Bullshit, there's a deal, Reacher said. There's always a deal. Silence again. It lasted minutes. Then Blake shrugged.
Well, you want to cooperate, we could compromise, he said. We could call Lamar a suicide. Grieving about her father, tormented she couldn't save her sister.
And you could keep your big mouth shut, Deerfield said. You could tell nobody nothing, except what we want them told. Silence again.
Why should I? Reacher said. Because you're a smart guy, Deerfield said. Don't forget there's absolutely nothing on Lamar. You know that. She was way too smart. Sure, you could dig around a couple of years if you had $1 million for lawyer bills. You could come up with a little meaningless, circumstantial stuff. But what's a jury going to do with that? A big man hates a small woman. He's a bum. She's a federal agent. He breaks her neck. And then he blames her for it? Some fantastic story about hypnosis. Forget about it.
So face it, okay? Blake said. You're ours now. There was silence. Then Reacher shook his head.
No, he said. I think I'll pass on that.
Then you go to jail.
Just one question first, Reacher said.
Which is?
Did I kill Lorraine Stanley?
Blake shook his head.
No, you didn't.
How do you know?
You know how we know. We had you tailed all week.
And you gave a copy of the surveillance report to my lawyer, right?
Right.
Okay, Reacher said.
Okay, what, smart guy?
Okay, nuts to you is what, Reacher said.
You want to expand on that?
Reacher shook his head. You figure it out. The room went quiet.
What?
Blake said. Reacher smiled at him. Think about strategy. Maybe you can lock me up for Lamar, but you can't ever claim I'm also the guy who killed the women, because my lawyer has got your own report proving that I'm not. So what are you going to do then?
What does that matter to you? Blake said. You're locked up anyway.
Think about the future, Reacher said. You've told the world it's not me, and you're swearing blind it's not Lamar. So you've got to be seen to keep on looking, right? You can't ever stop. Not without people wondering why. Think about the negative headlines. Elite FBI unit gets nowhere. 10th year of search. You'd just have to swallow them. Now you'd have to keep the guards in place. You'd have to work around the clock. More and more manpower, more and more effort, more and more budget, year after year, searching for the guy. Are you going to do that?
Silence in the room.
No, you're not going to do that, Reacher said. And not doing that is the same thing as admitting you know the truth. Lamar is dead. The search is stopped. It wasn't me. Therefore, Lamar was the killer. So it's all or nothing now for you guys.
It's make-your-mind-up time. If you don't admit it was Lamar, then you use up all your resources for the rest of history pretending to look for a guy you know for sure doesn't exist. And if you do admit it was Lamar, then you can't lock me up for killing her, because in the circumstances, it was absolutely justifiable. Silence again. So, nuts to you, Reacher said. There was silence. Reacher smiled. So now what? He asked. They were quiet for a long moment. Then they recovered. We're the Bureau, Deerfield said. We can make your life very difficult. Reacher shook his head. My life's already very difficult, he said. Nothing you guys can do to make it any harder. But you can stop with the threats anyway, because I'll keep your secret. You will? Reacher nodded. I'll have to, won't I? Because if I don't, it'll all just come back on Rita Semeca. She's the only living witness. She'll get pestered to death. Prosecutors, police, newspapers, television. All the sordid details. How she was raped. How she was naked in the tub with the paint. It'll hurt her. And I don't want that to happen. Silence again. So your secret is safe with me, Reacher said. Blake stared at the tabletop. Then he nodded. Okay, he said. I'll buy that. But we'll be watching you, Deerfield said. Always. Never forget that. Reacher smiled again. Well, don't let me catch you at it, he said. Because you should remember what happened to Petrosian. You guys never forget that. Okay? It finished like that as a tie, as a wary stalemate. Nothing more was said. Reacher stood up and threaded his way around the table and out of the room. He found an elevator and made it down to street level. Nobody came after him. There were double doors, scarred oak and wired glass. He pushed them open and stepped out into the chill of some dark, deserted Portland street in the middle of the night. Stood on the edge of the sidewalk looking at nothing in particular.
Hey, Reacher!
Harper called. She was behind him in the shadow of a pillar flanking the entrance. He turned and saw the gleam of her hair and a stripe of white where her shirt showed at the front of her jacket. Hey, yourself, he said. You okay? She stepped across to him.
I will be, she said. I'm going to ask for a transfer. Maybe over here. I like it.
Will they let you? She nodded.
Sure they will. They're not going to rock any boats as long as the budget hearings are on. This is going to be the quietest thing that ever happened.
It never happened at all, he said. That's how we left it upstairs.
So, you're okay with them?
As okay as I ever was.
I'd have stood up for you, she said. Whatever it took.
He nodded. I know you would. There should be more like you.
Take this, she said.
She held out a slip of flimsy paper. It was a travel voucher issued by the desk back at Quantico.
It'll get you to New York, she said.
What about you? He asked.
I'll say I lost it. They'll wire me another one.
She stepped close and kissed his cheek, stepped away and started walking. Good luck, she called. To you too, he called back. He walked to the airport, 12 miles on the shoulders of roads built for automobiles. It took him 3 hours. He exchanged the FBI voucher for a plane ticket and waited another hour for the first flight out. Slept through 4 hours in the air and 3 hours of time zones, and touched down at LaGuardia at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He used the last of his cash on a bus to the subway and the subway into Manhattan. Got out at Canal Street and walked south to Wall Street. He was in the lobby of Jody's office building a few minutes after 2 o'clock, borne along by 60 floors of workers returning from lunch. Her firm's reception area was deserted. Nobody at the counter. He stepped through an open door and wandered down a corridor lined with law books on oak shelves. Left and right of him were empty offices. There were papers on desks and jackets over the backs of chairs, but no people anywhere. He came to a set of double doors and heard the heavy buzz of conversation on the other side. The chink of glass on glass. Laughter. He pulled the right-hand door and the noise burst out at him,
and he saw a conference room jammed full of people. They were in dark suits and snowy white shirts and suspenders and quiet ties and severe dark dresses and black nylon. There was a wall of blinding windows and a long table under a heavy white cloth loaded with ranks of sparkling glasses and 100 bottles of champagne. Two bartenders were pouring the foamy golden wine as fast as they could. People were drinking it and toasting with it and looking at Jody. She was rippling through the crowd like a magnet. Wherever she walked, people stepped up and formed a crowd around her. There was a constantly changing sequence of small, excited circles with her at every center. She turned left and right, smiling, clinking glasses, and then moved on randomly like a pinball into new acclaim. She saw him at the door, at the same moment he saw himself reflected in a glass over a Renoir drawing on the wall. He was unshaven, and dressed in a crumpled khaki shirt dried stiff with random green stains. She was in a $1,000 dress fresh from the closet. 100 faces turned with hers, and the room fell silent. She hesitated for a beat, like she was making a decision. Then she fought forward through the crowd and flung her arms around his neck, champagne glass and all. "The partnership party," he said. "You got it."
"I sure did," she said.
"Well, congratulations, babe," he said. "And I'm sorry I'm late." She drew him into the crowd and people closed around them. He shook hands with 100 lawyers the way he used to with generals from foreign armies. "Don't mess with me, and I won't mess with you." The top boy was an old red and gray-faced man of about 65, the son of one of the names on the brass plaque in reception. His suit must have cost more than all the clothes Reacher had ever worn in his life. But the mood of the party meant there was no edge in the old guy's attitude. He looked like he would have been delighted to shake hands with Jody's elevator man. "She's a big, big star," he said, "and I'm gratified she accepted our offer." "Smartest lawyer I ever met," Reacher said over the noise. "Will you go with her?"
"Go with her where?"
"To London," the old guy said. "Didn't she explain? First tour of duty for a new partner is running the European operation for a couple of years." Then she was back at his side, smiling, drawing him away. The crowd was settling into small groups, and conversation was turning to work matters and quiet gossip. She led him to a space by the window. There was a yard-wide view of the harbor framed by sheer buildings on either side.
"I called the FBI uptown," she said. "I was worried about you. And technically I'm still your lawyer. I spoke with Alan Deerfield's office."
"When?"
2 hours ago. They wouldn't tell me anything."
"Nothing to tell. They're straight with me. I'm straight with them." She nodded.
"So you delivered, finally."
Then she paused.
"Will you be called as a witness?" she asked. "Is there going to be a trial?"
He shook his head.
"No trial."
She nodded.
"Just a funeral, right?"
He shrugged. "There are no relatives left. That was the point." She paused again, like there was an important question coming up.
"How do you feel about it?" she asked. "One-word answer."
"Calm," he said.
"Would you do it again? Same circumstances?"
He paused in turn. "Same circumstances?" he said. "In a heartbeat."
"I have to go to work in London," she said. 2 years.
"I know," he said. "The old guy told me. When do you go?"
"End of the month."
"You don't want me to come with you," he said.
"It'll be very busy. It's a small staff with a big workload."
"And it's a civilized city."
She nodded. "Yes, it is." "Would you want to come?"
2 straight years? He said, "No. But maybe I could visit time to time."
She smiled vaguely. "That would be good."
He said nothing.
"This is awful," she said. 15 years I couldn't live without you. And now I find I can't live with you."
"I know," he said. "Totally my fault."
"Do you feel the same way?"
He looked at her. "I guess I do," he lied.
"We've got until the end of the month," she said.
He nodded. More than most people get, he said. Can you take the afternoon off?
Sure I can. I'm a partner now. I can do what I want.
So, let's go. They left their empty glasses on the window ledge and threaded their way through the knots of people. Everybody watched them to the door and then turned back to their quiet speculations.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Echo Burning, Book 5 in the Jack Reacher series, free.
This is Jonathan McLean. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Running Blind by Lee Child. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by Bob Dion. Running Blind is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved. The book Running Blind is available wherever Berkeley books are sold.
And now, a free preview of Echo Burning, Book 5 in the Jack Reacher series.
People think that writing is a lonely, solitary trade. They're wrong. It's a team game, and I'm lucky enough to have charming and talented people on my side everywhere I'm published. Accordingly, if you ever worked on or sold one of my books, this one is dedicated to you. You're too numerous to mention individually, but too important not to mention at all. Lee Child. Echo Burning. 1. There were three watchers, two men and a boy. They were using telescopes, not field glasses. It was a question of distance. They were almost a mile from their target area because of the terrain. There was no closer cover. It was low, undulating country, burned khaki by the sun, grass and rock and sandy soil alike. The nearest safe concealment was the broad dip they were in, a bone-dry gulch scraped out a million years ago by a different climate, when there had been rain and ferns and rushing rivers. The men lay prone in the dust with the early heat on their backs, their telescopes at their eyes. The boy scuttled around on his knees, fetching water from the cooler, watching for waking rattlesnakes, logging comments in a notebook. They had arrived before first light in a dusty pickup truck, the long way around, across the empty land from the west. They had thrown a dirty tarpaulin over the truck and held it down with rocks. They had eased forward to the rim of the dip and settled in, raising their telescopes as the low morning sun dawned to the east behind the red house almost a mile away. This was Friday, their fifth consecutive morning, and they were low on conversation.
Tam?
One of the men asked. His voice was nasal, the effect of keeping one eye open and the other eye shut. The boy checked his watch.
6:50, he answered. Any moment now,
the man with the telescope said. The boy opened his book and prepared to make the same notes he had made four times before.
Kitchen light on,
the man said. The boy wrote it down. 6:50, kitchen light on. The kitchen faced them, looking west away from the morning sun, so it stayed dark even after dawn.
On her own? The boy asked.
Same as always, the second man said, squinting.
Maid prepares breakfast, the boy wrote. Target still in bed. The sun rose, inch by inch. It jacked itself higher into the sky and pulled the shadows shorter and shorter. The red house had a tall chimney coming out of the kitchen wing like the finger on a sundial. The shadow it made swung and shortened, and the heat on the watcher's shoulders built higher. 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was already hot. By 8, it would be burning. By 9, it would be fearsome. And they were there all day, until dark, when they could slip away unseen.
Bedroom drapes opening, the second man said. She's up and about.
The boy wrote it down. 7:04, bedroom drapes open.
Now listen,
the first man said. They heard the well pump kick in, faintly from almost a mile away. A quiet, mechanical click, and then a steady low drone.
She's showering,
the man said. The boy wrote it down. 7:06, target starts to shower. The men rested their eyes. Nothing was going to happen while she was in the shower. How could it? They lowered their telescopes and blinked against the brassy sun in their eyes. The well pump clicked off after 6 minutes. The silence seemed louder than the faint noise had. The boy wrote, 7:12, target out of shower. The men raised their telescopes again.
She's dressing, I guess,
the first man said. The boy giggled.
Can you see her naked?
The second man was triangulated 20 feet to the south. He had the better view of the back of the house where her bedroom window was.
You're disgusting, he said. You know that?
The boy wrote, 7:15, probably dressing. Then, 7:20, probably downstairs, probably eating breakfast.
She'll go back up, brush your teeth, he said.
The man on the left shifted on his elbows.
For sure, he said. Prissy little thing like that.
She's closing her drapes again, the man on the right said.
It was standard practice in the west of Texas in the summer, especially if your bedroom faced south like this one did, unless you wanted to sleep the next night in a room hotter than a pizza oven.
Stand by, the man said. Buck gets 10, she goes out to the barn now.
It was a wager that nobody took, because so far, 4 times out of 4, she had done exactly that, and watchers are paid to notice patterns.
Kitchen door's open,
the boy wrote. 7:27, kitchen door opens.
Here she comes.
She came out, dressed in a blue gingham dress that reached to her knees and left her shoulders bare. Her hair was tied back behind her head. It was still damp from the shower.
What do you call that sort of a dress?
The boy asked.
Halter,
the man on the left said. 7:28, comes out, blue halter dress, goes to barn, the boy wrote. She walked across the yard, short, hesitant steps against the uneven ruts in the baked earth, maybe 70 yards. She heaved the barn door open and disappeared in the gloom inside. The boy wrote, 7:29, target in barn.
How hot is it?
The man on the left asked.
Maybe 100 degrees,
the boy said.
There'll be a storm soon. Heat like this there has to be.
Here comes a ride,
the man on the right said. Miles to the south there was a dust cloud on the road, a vehicle making slow and steady progress north.
She's coming back,
the man on the right said. 7:32, target comes out of barn, the boy wrote.
Maid's at the door, the man said.
The target stopped at the kitchen door and took her lunchbox from the maid. It was bright blue plastic with a cartoon picture on the side. She paused for a second. Her skin was pink and damp from the heat. She leaned down to adjust her socks and then trotted out to the gate, through the gate, to the shoulder of the road. The school bus slowed and stopped, and the door opened with a sound the watchers heard clearly over the faint rattle of the idling engine. The chrome handrails flashed once in the sun. The diesel exhaust hung and drifted in the hot, still air. The target heaved her lunchbox onto the step and grasped the bright rails and clambered up after it. The door closed again, and the watchers saw her corn-colored head bobbing along level with the base of the windows. Then the engine noise deepened, and the gears caught, and the bus moved away with a new cone of dust kicking up behind it. 7:36, target on bus to school, the boy wrote. The road north was dead straight, and he turned his head and watched the bus all the way until the heat on the horizon broke it up into a shimmering yellow mirage. Then he closed his notebook and secured it with a rubber band. Back at the red house, the maid stepped inside and closed the kitchen door. Nearly a mile away, the watchers lowered their telescopes and turned their collars up for protection from the sun. 7:37, Friday morning. 7:38. 7:39, more than 300 miles to the north and east, Jack Reacher climbed out of his motel room window. 1 minute earlier, he had been in the bathroom brushing his teeth. 1 minute before that, he had opened the door of his room to check the morning temperature. He had left it open, and the closet just inside the entrance passageway was faced with mirrored glass, and there was a shaving mirror in the bathroom on a cantilevered arm, and by a freak of optical chance, he caught sight of 4 men getting out of a car and walking toward the motel office. Pure luck. But a guy as vigilant as Jack Reacher gets lucky more times than the average. The car was a police cruiser. It had a shield on the door, and because of the bright sunlight and the double reflection, he could read it clearly. At the top it said City Police, and then there was a fancy medallion in the middle with Lubbock, Texas written underneath. All four men who got out were in uniform. They had bulky belts with guns and radios and nightsticks and handcuffs. Three of the men he had never seen before, but the fourth guy was familiar. The fourth guy was a tall heavyweight with a gelled blonde brush cut above a meaty red face. This morning, the meaty red face was partially obscured by a glinting aluminum splint carefully taped over a shattered nose. His right hand was similarly bound up with a splint and bandages protecting a broken forefinger. The guy had neither injury the night before, and Reacher had no idea the guy was a cop. He just looked like some idiot in a bar. Reacher had gone there because he heard the music was good, but it wasn't, so he had backed away from the band and ended up on a bar stool watching ESPN on a muted television fixed high on a wall. The place was crowded and noisy, and he was wedged in a space with a woman on his right and the heavyweight guy with the brush cut on his left. He got bored with the sports and turned around to watch the room. As he turned, he saw how the guy was eating. The guy was wearing a white tank top shirt, and he was eating chicken wings. The wings were greasy, and the guy was a slob. He was dripping chicken fat off his chin and off his fingers onto his shirt. There was a dark teardrop shape right between his pecs. It was growing and spreading into an impressive stain. But the best barroom etiquette doesn't let you linger on such a sight, and the guy caught Reacher staring. "Who are you looking at?" he said. It was said low and aggressively, but Reacher ignored it. "Who you looking at?" the guy said again. Reacher's experience was, they say it once, maybe nothing's going to happen. But they say it twice, then trouble's on the way. Fundamental problem is, they take a lack of response as evidence that you're worried, that they're winning. But then, they won't let you answer anyway. "You looking at me?" the guy said. "No," Reacher answered. "Don't you be looking at me, boy," the guy said. The way he said, "boy," made Reacher think he was maybe a foreman in a lumber mill or a cotton operation. Whatever muscle work was done around Lubbock. Some kind of a traditional trade passed down through the generations. Certainly the word cop never came to his mind. But then he was relatively new to Texas. "Don't you look at me," the guy said. Reacher turned his head and looked at him. Not really to antagonize the guy, just to size him up. Life is endlessly capable of surprises, so he knew one day he would come face to face with his physical equal, with somebody who might worry him. But he looked and saw this wasn't the day, so he just smiled and looked away again. Then the guy jabbed him with his finger. "I told you not to look at me," he said, and jabbed. It was a meaty forefinger, and it was covered in grease. It left a definite mark on Reacher's shirt. "Don't do that," Reacher said. The guy jabbed again.
"Or what?" he said. "You want to make something out of it?"
Reacher looked down. Now there were two marks. The guy jabbed again. Three jabs, three marks. Reacher clamped his teeth. What were three greasy marks on his shirt? He started a slow count to 10. Then the guy jabbed again before he even reached 8.
"You deaf?" Reacher said.
"I told you not to do that."
"You want to do something about it?"
"No," Reacher said. "I really don't. I just want you to stop doing it, is all." The guy smiled.
"Then you're a yellow-bellied piece of shit."
"Whatever," Reacher said. "Just keep your hands off me."
"Or what? What are you going to do?"
Reacher restarted his count. 8, 9.
"You want to take this outside?" the guy said.
10. "Touch me again and you'll find out," Reacher said. "I warned you 4 times. The guy paused a second. Then, of course, he went for it again. Reacher caught the finger on the way in and snapped it at the first knuckle, just folded it upward like he was turning a door handle. Then, because he was irritated, he leaned forward and headbutted the guy full in the face. It was a smooth move, well delivered, but it was backed off to maybe a half of what it might have been. No need to put a guy in a coma over 4 grease marks on his shirt. He moved a pace to give the man room to fall, and backed into the woman on his right.
Excuse me, ma'am, he said. The woman nodded vaguely, disoriented by the noise, concentrating on her drink, unaware of what was happening. The big guy thumped silently on the floorboards, and Reacher used the sole of his shoe to roll him half onto his front. Then he nudged him under the chin with his toe to pull his head back and straighten his airway. The recovery position, paramedics call it, stops you choking while you're out. Then he paid for his drinks and walked back to his motel, and didn't give the guy another thought until he was at the bathroom mirror and saw him out and about in a cop's uniform. Then he thought hard, and as fast as he could. He spent the first second calculating reflected angles and figuring, if I can see him, does that mean he can see me? The answer was, yes, of course he can, if he was looking the right way, which he wasn't yet. He spent the next second mad at himself. He should have picked up the signs. They had been there. Who else would be poking at a guy built like him, except somebody with some kind of protected status, some kind of imagined invulnerability? He should have picked up on it. So what to do? The guy was a cop on his own turf, and Reacher was an easily recognizable target. Apart from anything else, he still had the four grease spots on his shirt and a brand new bruise on his forehead. There were probably forensics people who could match its shape to the bones in the guy's nose. So what to do? An angry cop bent on revenge could cause trouble, a lot of trouble. A noisy public arrest, for sure. Maybe some wild gunshots. Definitely some four-on-one fun and games in an empty out-of-the-way cell down at the station house, where you can't fight back without multiplying your original legal problem. Then, all kinds of difficult questions. Because Reacher habitually carried no ID and nothing else at all except his toothbrush and a couple of $1,000 cash in his pants pocket. So he would be regarded as a suspicious character. Almost certainly he'd be charged with attacking a law officer. That was probably a big deal in Texas. All kinds of witnesses would materialize to swear it was malicious and completely unprovoked. He could end up convicted and in the penitentiary, easy as anything. He could end up with 7 to 10 in some tough establishment, which was definitely not number one on his wish list. So discretion was going to be the better part of valor. He put his toothbrush in his pocket and walked through the room and opened the window, unclipped the screen and dropped it to the ground, climbed out and closed the window and rested the screen back in its frame, and walked away across a vacant lot to the nearest street. Turned right and kept on walking until he was hidden by a low building. He looked for buses. There weren't any. He looked for taxis. Nothing doing. So he stuck out his thumb. He figured he had 10 minutes to find a ride before they finished at the motels and started cruising the streets. 10 minutes. Maybe 15 at the outside. Which meant it wasn't going to work. It couldn't work. 7:39 in the morning, the temperature was already over 100 degrees. It was going to be impossible to get a ride at all. In heat like that, no driver on the planet would open their door long enough for him to slide right in, never mind for any long prior discussions about destinations. So finding a getaway in time was going to be impossible, absolutely impossible. He started planning alternatives because he was so sure of it. But it turned out he was wrong. It turned out his whole day was a series of surprises. There were three killers, two men and a woman. They were an out-of-state professional crew, based in Los Angeles, contactable through an intermediary in Dallas and a second cutout in Vegas. They had been in business 10 years, and they were very good at what they did, which was take care of problems anywhere in the Southwest and survive to get paid and do it over again as many times as anybody asked them to. 10 years, and never once a hint of a problem. A good team. Meticulous, inventive, perfectionist. As good as it gets in their strange little world. And perfectly suited to it. They were bland, forgettable, white, anonymous. To see them together, they looked like the branch office of a photocopier company on its way to a sales convention. Not that they were ever seen together, except by their victims. They traveled separately. One always drove, and the other two flew, always by different routes. The driver was one of the men, because invisibility was their aim, and a woman driving a long distance alone was still slightly more memorable than a man.
The car was always rented, always at LAX Arrivals, which had the busiest rental counters in the world. It was always a generic family sedan, a mud-colored nothing car. The license and the credit card used to obtain it were always real, properly issued in a distant state to a person who had never existed. The driver would wait on the sidewalk and then line up when a busy flight was spilling out into baggage claim, when he would be just one face among 100. He was small and dark and had a rolling duffel and a carry-on and a harassed expression, same as everybody else. He did the paperwork at the counter and rode the bus to the rental compound and found his allotted car. He dumped his bags in the trunk, waited at the exit check, and drove out into the glare. He spent 40 minutes on the freeways, driving a wide, aimless circle around the whole of the metropolitan area, making sure he wasn't followed. Then he ducked off into West Hollywood and stopped at a lock-up garage in an alley behind a lingerie salon. He left the motor running and opened the garage door and opened the trunk and swapped his rolling duffel and his carry-on for 2 big valises made of thick black nylon. One of them was very heavy. The heavy valise was the reason he was driving, not flying. It contained things best kept away from airport scanners. He closed up the garage and rolled east on Santa Monica Boulevard and turned south on 101 and hooked east again on 10, squirmed in his seat and settled in for the 2-day drive all the way out to Texas. He wasn't a smoker, but he lit numerous cigarettes and held them between his fingers and flicked ash on the carpets, on the dash, on the wheel. He let the cigarettes burn out and crush the butts in the ashtray. That way, the rental company would have to vacuum the car very thoroughly and spray it with air freshener and wipe down the vinyl with detailing fluid. That would eliminate every trace of him later, including his fingerprints. The second man was on the move, too. He was taller and heavier and fairer, but there was nothing memorable about him. He joined the end-of-the-workday crush at LAX and bought a ticket to Atlanta. When he got there, he swapped his wallet for one of the 5 spares in his carry-on, and a completely different man bought another ticket for Dallas-Fort Worth. The woman traveled a day later. That was her privilege, because she was the team leader. She was closing in on middle age, medium-sized, medium-blonde. Nothing at all special about her, except she killed people for a living. She left her car in the LAX long-term parking, which wasn't dangerous, because her car was registered to a Pasadena infant who had died of the measles 30 years previously. She rode the shuttle bus to the terminal and used a forged MasterCard to buy her ticket and a genuine New York driver's license for photo ID at the gate. She boarded her plane about the time the driver was starting his second day on the road. After his second stop for gas on the first day, he had made a detour into the New Mexico hills and found a quiet, dusty shoulder where he squatted in the cool, thin air and changed the car's California plates for Arizona plates, which he took from the heavier valise. He wound his way back to the highway and drove another hour, then pulled off the road and found the motel. He paid cash, used the Tucson address, and let the desk clerk copy the Arizona plate number onto the registration form. He slept 6 hours with the room air on low, and was back on the road early. Made it to Dallas-Fort Worth at the end of the second day, and parked in the airport long-term lot. Took his valises with him, and used the shuttle bus to departures. Took the moving stairs straight down to arrivals and lined up at the Hertz counter. Hertz, because they rent Fords, and he needed a Crown Victoria. He did the paperwork with Illinois ID. Rode the bus to the Hertz lot and found his car. It was the plain Jane Crown Vic, in steel, blue, metallic, neither light nor dark. He was happy with it. He heaved his bags into the trunk and drove to a motel near the new ballpark on the road from Fort Worth to Dallas. Checked in with the same Illinois ID, ate, and slept a few hours. He woke early and met his 2 partners in the fierce morning heat outside the motel at exactly the same moment Jack Reacher first stuck out his thumb, more than 400 miles away in Lubbock. Second surprise after the cop showing up was he got a ride within 3 minutes. He wasn't even sweating yet. His shirt was still dry. Third surprise was the driver who stopped for him was a woman. Fourth, and biggest surprise of all, was the direction their subsequent conversation took. He had been hitching rides for the best part of 25 years, in more countries than he could easily recall, and 3 minutes was about the shortest interval between sticking out his thumb and climbing into a car he could remember. As a mode of transportation, hitching rides was dying out. That was his conclusion, based on a lot of experience. Commercial drivers had insurance problems with it, and private citizens were getting worried about it. Because who knew what kind of a psycho you were? And in Reacher's case, it was worse than the average, especially right then. He wasn't some dapper little guy, neat and inoffensive. He was a giant, 6'5", heavily built, close to 250 pounds. Up close, he was usually scruffy, usually unshaven, and his hair was usually a mess. People worried about him. They stayed away from him. And now he had the fresh new bruise on his forehead, which was why he was surprised about the 3 minutes, and why he was surprised about the woman driver. There's usually a pecking order based on some kind of subconscious assessment of risk. Top of the list? A young girl will get a ride from an older man, easiest of all, because where's the threat in that? Although now, with some of the young girgirls turning into scam artists, wanting $100 in exchange for dropping fake molestation claims, even that is getting harder. And whatever, right down there at the bottom of the list, is a big scruffy guy getting a ride from a neat, slender woman in an expensive coupe. But it happened. Within 3 minutes. He was hurrying south and west of the motel strip, stunned by the heat, hard to see in the jagged morning shadows, his left thumb jammed out urgently, when she pulled over at his side with the wet hiss of wide tires on hot pavement. It was a big, white car, and the sun on the hood dazzled him. He turned blindly, and she buzzed her far window down. 7:42, Friday morning.
"Where to?"
she called, like she was a cab driver, not a private citizen. "Anywhere," he said. He regretted it instantly. It was a dumb thing to say, because to have no specific destination usually makes things worse. They think you're some kind of an aimless drifter, which makes them suspicious and makes them worried they might never get rid of you. Makes them worried you'll want to ride all the way home with them. But this woman just nodded.
"Okay,"
she said. "I'm headed down past Pecos." He paused a beat, surprised. Her head was ducked down, her face tilted up, looking out at him through the window. "Great," he said. He stepped off the curb and opened the door and slid inside. The interior was freezing cold. She had the air roaring on maximum, and the seat was leather and it felt like a block of ice. She buzzed the window up again with the button on her side as he swung the door shut behind him. "Thanks," he said. "You don't know how much I appreciate this." She said nothing, just made some kind of all-purpose dismissive gesture away from him as she craned to look over her shoulder at the traffic stream behind her. People have their reasons for giving rides, all of them different. Maybe they hitched a lot when they were younger, and now they're settled and comfortable. They want to put back what they took out, like a circular thing. Maybe they have charitable natures, or maybe they're just lonely and want a little conversation. But if this woman wanted conversation, she was in no kind of a hurry to get it started. She just waited for a couple of trucks to labor past and pulled out behind them without a word. Reacher glanced around inside the car. It was a Cadillac, 2 doors but as long as a boat and very fancy. Maybe a couple of years old, but as clean as a whistle. The leather was the color of old bones, and the glass was tinted like an empty bottle of French wine. There was a pocketbook and a small briefcase thrown on the back seat. The pocketbook was anonymous and black, maybe plastic. The briefcase was made from weathered cowhide, the sort of thing that already looks old when you buy it. It was zipped open, and there was a lot of folded paper stuffed in it, the sort of thing you see in a lawyer's office.
"Move the seat back, if you want," the woman said. "Give yourself room."
"Thanks," he said again. He found switches on the door, shaped like seat cushions. He fiddled with them, and quiet motors eased him rearward and reclined his backrest. Then he lowered the seat to make himself inconspicuous from outside. The motors whirred. It was like being in a dentist's chair.
"That looks better," she said. more comfortable for you.
Her own chair was tight up to the wheel, because she was small. He twisted in his seat so he could look her over without staring straight at her. She was short and slim, dark-skinned, fine-boned, altogether a small person, maybe 100 pounds, maybe 30 years old. Long, black, wavy hair, dark eyes, small white teeth visible behind a tense half-smile. Mexican, he guessed, but not the type of Mexican who swims the Rio Grande looking for a better life. This woman's ancestors had enjoyed a better life for hundreds of years. That was pretty clear. It was in her genes. She looked like some kind of Aztec royalty.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Echo Burning, Book 5 in the Jack Reacher series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.